Welcome to Your True North, a program that explores how values act as a compass, directing our lives and work. Inspiring guests tell how key events and influential figures shaped their values and how they've used those values to create a life rich in meaning, accomplishments, and personal satisfaction. Your True North is hosted by Cindy Camp. Are you seeking your true north? Then welcome.
Welcome to Your True North, a show that explores how values act as a compass for life's journey. I'm your host, Cindy Camp, and today I will be talking with Forrest Perry, an associate professor of philosophy at St. Xavier University in Chicago. He earned his doctorate at Vanderbilt University, where he also worked in the Center for Teaching, the Writing Studio, and the Center for Ethics. It's my pleasure to welcome you today, Forrest. You know, you've talked now a little bit about a couple of things that seem to be at the center of your life. So not dismissing people whose opinions differ from your own. Your interest in seeing that everyone have more of a fair sort of seat at the table. Mm-hmm. Is religion any part of your, has that been any part of your sort of arriving at those values? Are you somebody who has a religious background?
I don't have much of a religious background unless you call going to Sunday school maybe 10 to 20 times. I don't know. I can't really remember unless you want to call that a religious background, which I suspect most people rightly would not. I would say that religion, so far as I know, has not had an impact on the types of views that I hold. In the past, I used to go through periods where I thought religion was ridiculous and that we should just get rid of it. And then there would be times when I was definitely more open to it. I mean, some of the people that I've respected most in my life were religious in some way, usually Christian in some way, just professors that I had and whatnot. And so that definitely, Martin Luther King Jr., for instance, Malcolm X. I mean, these are people who were obviously religious. So, I would not say that religion has influenced my views, but I'm also not as dismissive of it as I was at certain periods in my life.
And I'm just curious. I'll just push this a little bit because I'm interested in this topic. I've talked with people who are really religious and who would say that their values, their sense of themselves was formed in large part by their religious commitments or their background as, you know, growing up within a religious community. Do you think it's possible to have a fully set or fully formed set of values that have nothing to do with religion?
I think so. Now, whether you can get from that full set of values the type of commitment that you see in people who are religious, I don't know. I mean, I would have to think a lot about that. I can say that there were times when I kind of thought it'd be nice to be religious and to have a kind of zeal, a kind of deep commitment to fighting for social justice, a commitment that would enable me to feel comfortable just saying, I don't care whether I have a job. I don't care whether I have a house. I've never been able to find that. I've never been able to find quite that. Feeling. I'm not sure that if I fully addressed your question. I think I forgot.
No, that's all right. I just was curious because I have had people say, well, without religion, how would a child really develop a sense of true values? And yeah. I think values, you know, certainly can be tied to religion, but I my own assessment is that they can also be completely independent of a religious background.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I think of most when I think about the relationship between religion and morality or religion and values is a text that I've taught a few times that any philosopher is familiar with. It's called the Euthyphro, and it's one of Plato's texts. And in the Euthyphro, Socrates asks Euthyphro. Euthyphro's he's this guy who's really religious, and he thinks he has all the answers. And it gets to a point where the question that Socrates asks, if we were to kind of translate it into a monotheistic perspective, it's basically, is something good because God says it is good, or does God say something is good because it just is good? Now, if you answer yes to the first part of the question, is something good because God says so? You go through a couple moves and you show that you can go from that to basically saying killing innocent children is fine. Why? Well, because God says so. So I'm not going to rehearse the argument. I probably would mess it up. And so that leaves you with saying yes to the other part of the question, namely, is something or does God say something is good because it just is good? So if you've said you can't say yes to the first part, it seems like you say yes to that part. But then it seems like you're saying there's something maybe outside of God that that is good, independent of God, that the good is somehow independent of God's will. And so if you run through the line of thinking that's offered up by that peculiar question asked by Socrates, I think where you get, at least if you were only focused on that text, I think what you get is that there is no real relationship between religion and values, in the sense that you are not going to be able to figure out what is the right thing to do simply by pointing to some kind of religious authority. You're not going to get anywhere with that. You might feel like you are, but then you have to confront the question that Socrates asks. And I don't know how you get out of that. I mean, I haven't taken the time to figure out ways to get out of it, but yeah, that's what I think of when I think about the relationship between religion and morality.
I'm remembering a student who said to me once, I am a philosophy major, not a religion major. And she said the reason is because philosophy is asking questions where religion is busy providing a lot of answers. And I found that very interesting because to your point, I mean, Socrates is just pushing a question and you know, obviously making the student have to think through where that takes you. Thank you. That was a great story.
Well, what the student said is great, too. I think that's very well put.
Let me ask you just a quick follow-up to that, because I know you have mentioned Karl Marx in our discussion, and in your reading of his great book, his kind of seminal work, Capital, you had some sort of aha moments yourself as you thought about what he was saying and how it became real to you. And I'm wondering if you'd just talk a little bit about that yet and how that kind of translates into your work in the classroom as well.
Yeah, I think that prior to reading volume one of Marx's Capital, I didn't read the whole thing. I think I didn't do the last couple of assignments, but it was at Vanderbilt University under the tutelage of Greg Horowitz, an excellent professor. I think it's so prior to reading volume one of Capital, my exposure to Marx was to what's called the early Marx. And I had read some of the Communist Manifesto, and none of that really stuck out at me. It didn't transform my thinking really in any way. I think the year prior to taking that course, my criticisms amounted to corporations are bad. Let's figure out how to control corporations. And so that's what's often referred to as just kind of a liberal critique, liberal in the sense of kind of left on the political spectrum. And it was in reading Capital that, I mean, reading Capital changed the way I see the world. So there are plenty of books that I've read that have given me information, very valuable information, and made me more knowledgeable. But there was something about reading Capital that changed the way that I see the world. And I guess one way of thinking about it is, people may be familiar with the movie The Sixth Sense. The kid says he can see dead people. In reading Capital, which is so much about disclosing the social relations that lie behind the things that we make use of every day, in reading that, I came to see, when I would look at things, I would see people. That is to say, I would see the people who made those things. I would think about the conditions under which they made them. And I would think about the extent to which those conditions were governed by the capitalist imperative to engage in profit making.
So you're saying you're standing in your kitchen and you're looking at the refrigerator or the toaster, and all of a sudden it isn't a toaster or refrigerator so much as something that's been made by people, and you're seeing the people who've made the object.
Yeah.
Is that what you're describing?
Not literally seeing the people. I'm not a crazy person, but, despite what some people probably think, given my political commitments. But yeah.
Right. But that you're starting to understand all the labor that went into that, object.
And it goes back to this idea of making meaning of the world, making connections. So I was seeing connections. I was seeing social relations rather than just things. Marx has this term reification. So the reification comes from the Latin word race, which means thing. So I often think of it as thingification. So instead of seeing social relations, we see things. And you see the thing and you get really excited. You go to Target or Target, you get really excited when you see the products there.
Yeah.
You'd be less excited if you started to think about, oh, under what conditions were those products made? What kind of impact has that had on the people? What kind of impact has that had on the environment? And I guess, I mean, one other way in which I try to get in the past, I've had students think about these connections. I've taught Michael Pollan's article Power Steer for many years. And what Pollan is doing in that article is he's telling what he calls it the biography of a cow that he has purchased and showing all the ways in which the meat that so many of us meet, that so many of us eat, the meat that comes from factory farms, is tied to all these awful things like nitrogen runoff and fecal dust. And in one article, he talks about these manure lagoons. So if we had a more natural system of raising these animals, their manure would be fertilizer in a pasture. But because they're concentrated in what are called concentrated animal feedlot operations, instead you have these things called manure lagoons, like these huge cesspools. And so when I was, one of the first times I taught this reading, I said to my students at one point, I said, so if when you start eating a hamburger, you start to see a manure lagoon, you're not hallucinating, you're understanding. And so, yes, yeah, seeing those connections, that's understanding. That's making meaning of your world. And that's what I'm trying to do, I guess, try to help people make their world more meaningful, or at least make more sense, make the social reality that they live make more sense than it otherwise would if they were not equipped with what I have found so valuable, which is this kind of systemic analysis.
Well, thank you for that very visceral sort of example and for helping us understand better Marx and your interest in him and all of the work that you do with your students. I have heard you mention a number of people now, and I'm just wondering if you'd say a little bit more about people who you really consider to be personal heroes or role models, whether for you or for your students. Who would you think of in that light?
I mean, the people whom I would take a bullet for are Glenn Greenwald and Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning. And so these are all people who are doing work that isn't necessarily connected to the stuff that I was just now talking about. Chelsea Manning is in prison for 35 years. For handing over to a news organization, WikiLeaks, I'll go ahead and call it a news organization, for handing over information to a news organization, none of which was classified as top secret or anything like that. Edward Snowden.
Just to kind of remind everyone, because that's some time back, what was that information about?
Chelsea Manning had access to, I think what was most famous, the thing that WikiLeaks published that was most famous was a video showing a U.S. military helicopter killing civilians. They thought that one or two of the people there were carrying guns, and apparently not. But yeah, they ended up bombing these people, and then they also bombed the people, I think, if I recall correctly, they bombed the people who came to help them.
And quite a few people died.
Yeah,
right. I mean,
yeah, and yeah, it has been a while, and so I don't remember all the details. But basically, Chelsea Manning was horrified by what she was seeing the U.S. military do, and she didn't just herself dump all that information and make all of it available. She turned it over to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks went through that material and redacted the stuff that could have harmed people and whatnot. And she's now serving 35 years in prison. You compare that to the people who lied us into war. You compare that to the executives on Wall Street. You compare that to the bank HSBC, which just over a year ago, it was found out that for decades it was illegally laundering money for Libya and for Iran. It was also laundering money for the Sinaloa drug cartel in Mexico. I mean, this is a murderous organization, and they were funneling money apparently for terrorist organizations as well. Not a single one of those people went to jail. Not a single one of them was criminally prosecuted. They had to pay a big fine, but no one was really held accountable. So yeah, if there's something that makes my blood boil, it is the misapplication of law. It appears that the best way to ensure that you don't get in prison is to do something extremely awful. So if you crash, if you steal a candy bar or a pair of socks, there's a guy who, because of the three strikes rule, spending all these years in jail because he stole a pair of socks. If you steal a pair of socks, you're going to jail. If you crash the entire economy, or you play a significant role in crashing the entire economy, you get bonuses. If you lie us into war, you get the Presidential Medal of Freedom. You get to continue to live your life. You can be a painter, an amateur painter like George W. Bush.
So some of these incredible ironies, and as you're saying, Chelsea Manning did something extraordinarily brave, mm-hmm. and from her point of view, something that she was morally called to do. Edward Snowden, Glenn Greenwald, maybe you want to say a little bit about them as well, but the irony that now someone like Chelsea Manning is actually sitting in jail.
Yeah.
So if you tell us a little bit about the other folks and why you also are sort of putting them up as her heroes.
Yeah, I mean, Edward Snowden, he turned over, he saw that the U.S. government was violating the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. It was spying on everyone in the world that it could, including American citizens. And this spying could take the form of, and some people are going to say, oh, you're crazy, you just sound paranoid. But no, just look it up. They had ways of, and still do, I'm sure, ways of remotely controlling the cameras on your electronic devices. They could peer in. Go ahead and watch the Snowden movie that's coming out in a day or two, and you'll see that. I've already seen clips of particular parts of the movie. I've read a fair amount about Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden saw what the U.S. government was doing under the auspices of the National Security Agency. And he also saw, he tried initially to go through the proper channel. So Hillary Clinton, you're a liar when you claim he could have done that and he didn't. He tried to a little bit to go through the proper channels, but then he started to see what was happening to all these whistleblowers. He saw what happened to Chelsea Manning. He saw what happened to Thomas Drake. He saw what happened to Jeffrey Sterling. He saw all these people stepping up and having their lives ruined, having been thrown in jail, and he had no other recourse than to turn over all this information, which has not harmed a single person. Again, that's a lie. You'll hear it all the time. It's like, oh, he harmed the United States. It's like, what are you talking about? Point to some evidence. So he turned that information over to Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, and I'm blanking on the name of the other journalist from The Guardian at the time. And Glenn Greenwald, I came to know of his work in graduate school. I had a housemate who pointed him out to me, and initially I thought it was Glenn Beck. And so I was a little confused. I think I didn't know who either of those people were at that time, and I saw Glenn Beck, and I said, is this the guy you're saying? He goes, no. So Glenn Greenwald comes across to me as probably like one of the most principled individuals ever. This is a guy who sticks with principles. This is a guy who will be as critical of Democratic leaders as he will be of Republican leaders. And for years and years, I couldn't find a single thing he wrote that I disagreed with at all. I mean, so maybe there's something wrong with me that I just agree wholeheartedly, but more recently, there's been some stuff I'm going, all right, I'm not sure why you're saying that. I'm not quite understanding. But that Glenn Greenwald is so sharp, and he's doing such crucial work. He's particularly good at exposing the hypocrisy of people in positions of power. So, yeah, he's Glenn Greenwald's a hero of mine.
If you think into the future, how would you like to be remembered? And if you want to say anything else yet about working with students.
Yeah, I think it would be nice to be remembered as someone who's particularly tall. No, I am tall. I'm one of the tallest teachers at the school. I would like to be remembered as a good teacher. Like, I mean, I know I do pretty well at making students laugh and be entertained, but what I mean by a good teacher is a teacher who engages students, not just by making them laugh, but by waking them up, helping them see things either that they weren't aware of or that they were aware of, but that they didn't really have the conceptual apparatus to make proper sense of, I guess. And so, I mean, one concrete way that might manifest itself is that some students down the road, especially when the country is continuing to experience massive unemployment and austerity measures and whatnot, my hope is that those students, certainly not all of them, I can't expect all of them, but plenty of students will say, I remember that class where we were talking about the nature of capitalism and how all of this stuff just goes hand in hand with capitalism. Like there's no mystery here that more and more people are being unemployed, that the unemployment levels have been increasing for the past 4 or 5 decades. It's no surprise that jobs are being offshored. It's no surprise that healthcare benefits are being cut. But then also I would hope, and this is the thing I guess I struggle with most to teach in no small part because I struggle with it myself, I would want those students to have hope of some sort, hope that they can do something, or a commitment to doing something, even if they don't have, say, full optimism in what they're doing. So I think that we need very significant social change, to say the least, in our society. And I'm particularly interested in looking at the type of social change that would be brought about by changes in how our economic system works and changes in how we interact with people across lines of racial difference. And I would hope that my students could, from maybe their own social positions, their own experiences, find the resources and find the hope and find the commitment to bring about social change that I don't think I can teach. I don't know how to teach. So yeah, I'm hoping that they could look back and go, yeah, that guy helped me see these things. And I can build off of that and do something to challenge what's going on right now.
I'm wondering a couple of closing questions. One is, and you know, again, you work with students every day. So young people, whether they're in college or not, thinking about their career path, thinking about what's going to be important to them as they get older, mm-hmm. and values, which are, I guess, part of that equation, and yet I think often more implied than talked about explicitly. So for someone to be thinking about what do they care about just at the absolute sort of core of who they are and how that translates into the path they walk with career, what thoughts do you have for young people about, I mean, you've clearly walked a path that most people don't. And
I am the 1%.
In a whole different kind of way.
Yeah.
Being a philosophy professor, being someone who's, you know, committed to socialism, who's critiquing society in ways that most people don't. But what would be your thoughts for someone who's 18 or 22 years old, who's trying to figure out what it is they're going to do with their life, the proverbial, what am I going to do with my life?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would point to all the empirical studies that have been done that indicate that making more money isn't necessarily going to increase your happiness. The empirical studies that have been done that show that it's the quality of your relations with other people that is determines your happiness much more than, again, how much money you make. And that satisfaction in the job that you do, feeling like you're making some kind of meaningful contribution, that's, at least if you're interested in being happy, not to say that being happy is our only measure of whether something is just or good or whatnot, but if you're interested in being happy, focus more on being satisfied with the job that you're doing than on making money. And there I'm just pointing to empirical studies. I'm pointing to things that have been, it seems, I think, pretty well demonstrated. by studies over the past many years. So yeah, focus on the satisfaction that you can get from your job. It's what you're going to be doing for many years at the very least.
I want to thank you very much for being with me today on Your True North. I'm your host, Cindy Camp. Please join us again next time for another conversation about values as a compass for life's journey.
You've been listening to Your True North with Cindy Camp. The opinions expressed on today's episode are not necessarily those of WXAV 88.3 FM, St. Xavier University, or the producers of Your True North. For a copy of today's program, you can download it as a podcast by visiting yourtruenorthpodcasts.com. Thank you very much for listening to Your True North.